Accession number 19629, Reel 5.
Sir Carol Mather, Reel 5. I think you were saying that the Royal Air Force was much keener on David Stirling than Montgomery was.
Yes, they were. in that it was in their, obviously in their direct interest that these German airfields should be destroyed. And they had the reconnaissance ability to find out what was going on there. So that David Stirling had a close liaison with the air commander of 8th Army, or GHQ. This was a kind of niche which he found where the enemy could be attacked with very effective results. Didn't go on for too long, but went on for about 18 months.
What did the enemy do in response to cut the effects of these attacks?
Well, they really concentrated on guards on the airfield.
This is passive defence, though, isn't it, really? An active defence would have meant the enemy trying to find you.
Oh, no, they didn't try and find us, funnily enough. It's funny enough, they didn't like coming down into the desert proper. We almost never came across German patrols or Italian patrols venturing further than, well, we were about 30 miles south than about 15 miles south. But they did it by aircraft entirely, and they would try and seek us out and destroy us by means of aircraft.
Seems rather strange they didn't put together some sort of long-range desert group of their
exactly.
own.
Exactly, they didn't, you see. There was this one Hungarian fellow about whom a film was made later. Name's tipped my tongue. Who was used as a spy by the Germans. He was actually Hungarian by birth. And he did penetrate as far... He was a pre-war desert explorer with people like Bagnold and those people. And he took part in many of the expeditions to try and find the lost oasis of Zazora, before the war, in the pre-war, in the 20s and 30s. and he was used as a spy by Rommel, and did this great journey across the desert using some of our dumps, which he discovered, and Almazi, as the chaplain I'm trying to think, Count Almazi. And he did manage to drop two spies in the Nile Valley. and the local Egyptians, who were rather hostile to us, helped him on his way to Cairo, or two of them actually. And when they got to Cairo, they had wireless sets with them, and they decided to hire a houseboat in the Nile. They had a dog with them, and the neighbors objected to the dog barking at night, so the Egyptian police came along to investigate, and when they said, well, there'd been complaints about your dog, the two Germans said, oh, we shot him, actually. So the Egyptians thought this was very strange from, they took to be two British people in the houseboat and reported it on, they were discovered.
What happened to them?
What?
What happened to them in the end?
Almazi? Well, he I don't know what happened to him. He was a Hungarian. He went back to Hungary at the beginning of the war. He didn't know quite what to do because he'd been working in Egypt. And he was recruited there by the Germans to work for them then he decided to do so and say he went to Rommel's headquarters as advisor. And but they never ventured into the desert proper at all, neither the Italians nor the Germans.
One thing you mentioned about air cooperation is being resupplied by airdrop.
Yes.
Particularly when you were withdrawing across the Katara Depression, you mentioned that you were resupplied by airdrop. Was that an effective way of resupply?
This was a one-off operation. This never happened to happen before. And there was a disused airstrip which the RAF thought they could use, landing on Bombay aircraft. And this was the only case of resupply by air which we had, actually. Apart from when we were in Kufra on a later raid, when we were able to fly in aircraft onto the landing strip there.
Do you think you might have benefited from resupply by airdrop? Might it have been a good way of resupplying?
It might, absolutely. Yes, I think probably a shortage of aircraft, rather. And we were doing it on a shoestring. And we didn't want to make demands which would be felt to be over the top.
Moving on to the attack on Benghazi, you mentioned that the force included two Honey tanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Were they an asset or a liability, in your opinion?
Major liability. Because we had an approach march of best part of 1,000 miles. And, of course, they consumed petrol in vast quantities, and they weren't used, really, to day after day doing a high mileage and probably getting bogged in the sand time to time. And the idea was that they should be introduced into the harbour at Benghazi to shoot up the shipping. But it was a bit of a far-fetched idea. The whole of the planning for the Benghazi raid and the similar raids which took place at the same time on Bachi and Tobruk were planned by GHQ Cairo. This was to try and destabilize the German position at El Alamein and to make them look over their shoulders and hopefully make them withdraw. but it became talked about and the security wasn't as good as it ought to have been. A lot of people were in the know and they knew that we were going to come to Benghazi. They probably had a pretty good idea we were going to do an attack on Tobruk as well. The whole operation was a terrible failure. The only advantage in it was that I think to a certain extent it did make the Germans' lines of communication rather vulnerable and they were worried about it.
Do you think that it made them divert substantial forces to protect the lines of communication?
Well, rumour had it that a German battalion was introduced into Benghazi when they got wind of this, but I think it's very much open to question as whether there was a German battalion there. We had some Arab spies who went into Benghazi and came back with rather alarmist reports about what was in there and the fact the Germans had reinforced and there was an anti-tank ditch which had been dug right round the city, all of which turned out to be untrue. And the spy who we did employ as a guide really was a treacherous fellow and led us into a cul-de-sac, kind of wadi, out of which we had great difficulty extracting ourselves.
Do you think he was in the pay of the enemy, that man?
I think probably, yes. I think probably a double agent, I think.
One of the things you mentioned about this operation is that a lot of your other ranks were entirely inexperienced in this sort of operation. How did you recruit them?
Or were that they just was given actually to you? More so in the final expedition I did, which was into Tripolitania.
Yes.
this was a result of the fact that Monty, not allowing David Stirling to recruit desert experienced people from the 8th Army. And so he had to go down around the infantry base depots and all these kind of places to try and recruit men. And they were, I'm afraid, totally inexperienced, both in desert driving or in any kind of operations. So this was a particular squadron I was with. We had, by that time, we had two squadrons. The first squadron was the experienced men, and the second squadron was made up of a lot of people who were inexperienced.
You said that when you got to the Kaga oasis, the Egyptian authorities there were rather difficult and demanding.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you think this was because they had a sympathy with the Germans or Italians, or because they
were simply... Well, we were always suspicious of the Egyptian authorities. See, Egypt, curiously enough, although we were using their country as a battleground and as a base, they were actually officially neutral. And so we always suspected that they, you know, were informing upon us. And this particular oasis is Kaga. Was one of the gateways to the desert, the southern desert. And they had their different soldiers there, and they had barriers and all this kind of thing. They wanted to count exactly how many vehicles we had, and which made us extremely suspicious. And we, as I described, we crashed through the barrier on one occasion, and then all pushed on, and the governor of Kaga got very overexcited about this and said that his instructions were that every vehicle should be counted and a number of the vehicle recorded in case people got lost in the desert. Of course, this is really pre-war practice.
Peacetime practice.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Mm.
But according to what you were saying, the Egyptian police were really quite cooperative about Count Almazi. They, you know, reported on him.
This was the, I think it was the Egyptian in the Upper Nile. It was the local Egyptian Mukhtar or mayor of the town, who I think was known to be a Nazi sympathizer, obviously, because that's why they went to him. Mm. But again, we were very worried about passing through some of these small towns up in the delta because we showed exactly who we were and what we were about. It's quite obvious we were going off into the desert on a major expedition.
You mentioned seeing Egyptian soldiers at Kaga. Did you have much contact with the Egyptian army as such?
None at all. The Egyptian army didn't actually... they weren't fighting with us, and so they didn't appear in the desert. But this was a province of Egypt, and the governor had at his disposal a certain number of Egyptian troops.
In your book, you say that on the way, on that journey from Kaga to Kufra, that difficult journey, men began to lose heart because of the difficult conditions and the heat and the trouble.
Well, we did have rather a mixed bag. I mean, there were, it wasn't the old originals who were part of my group, who I had. there were a lot of new men, and we had a lot of sailors, too, because they were going to play a part when we got to Benghazi Harbour.
Yes.
And they got rather bolshy.
Did they?
And... as I say, we wouldn't have allowed in our men. we were the last column. There were three columns. We were the last column. And we got left with all the stuff that had been left out from the other columns. And so we were grossly overladen, and we were getting bogged and stuck and all the rest of it. And the result was that our petrol reserves ran very low.
Was there anything you could do to maintain or restore morale when it started to sink in those conditions? Anything you could do in a practical sense to keep them going?
Well, I mean, I expect one got the men together and told them what we were, what the situation was, where we were going to, and all the rest of it. but in a way, these the sailors of whom I complained weren't really under our command, so it was quite difficult dealing with them. It was their own officers really who had to deal with them. Very soon it resolved itself, because we then found we had run out of petrol and we had about another 350 miles to go. And there was only one thing for it, and that was to send a couple of jeeps on with the reserves of petrol we had to reach Kufa Oasis and explain what had happened and send a rescue party out.
Also, it seems that you weren't getting a lot of sympathy from the staff back in Cairo, because you described sending them a signal.
Well, we found ourselves dealing with a staff who we didn't know, and who weren't known to them, and they weren't known to us, and they took a rather kind of officious line.
In the plan, I think you were intending at one stage to attack a barracks and seize the car park next to it.
Yes.
Yes. Do you think you had a sufficient force to do that? Because I think there were only about five of you, weren't there, attacking a whole barracks.
Very good question. Well, this was all supposed to be the element of a surprise. And, of course, it, on the face of it, it was an impossible task. And only by surprise would it have been at all effective. But I think by that time, the surprise would have gone, because we've been making quite a lot of noise in the harbour.
It was about your third task,
yes,
wasn't it?
I mean, that. Yes, that's right, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, every officer was given, on the face of it, an impossible task. And it was only by surprise and dash that we could possibly have achieved any of these objectives.
On the withdrawal, you mentioned that you were particularly concerned about the Italian CR-41 aircraft.
Yeah, 42, flying. I think it was.
CR-42, mm. Yes. Why was it you were so particularly concerned about those?
Because they were very slow, and they could move very slowly, manoeuvring over, and therefore they were very good at spotting.
Do you think that it's still the case that slow aircraft are much better for that sort of task?
Well, I suppose these tank busters, you see, are that type of aircraft. Mm. They're slow and heavy, and can fly low. Certainly, from the point of view of reconnaissance, a rather ancient, slower aeroplane is more useful than a high-speed jet. Mm.
And you mentioned that later on you were caught in the open by a Mackie,
yes,
an Italian
fighter,
and strafed. And it caught you. Was there anything you could do to defend yourselves against their attack?
Absolutely nothing.
Nothing.
No. No, you just had to get as far away from your vehicles as you could, because of danger of explosion, and the vehicles were the targets. And so you scrambled off, trying to get behind a bush of some sort. And there's nothing you could do. You were pinned to the ground, really. You couldn't move. Once they started, you were pinned to the ground.
You marked that after this raid on Benghazi that went wrong, you were exhausted but had no psychological problems.
No what?
No psychological problems.
We didn't have psychological problems in those
days.
We
didn't. Why not? Everyone has them these days.
Oh, this is a modern invention.
It's a modern invention.
Yes, entirely.
It is.
Absolutely.
Is it all a matter of intellectual fashion, do you think, to have...
Yes, absolutely.
So
yeah.
Post-traumatic stress disorder is just a...
And we had no counselling, whatever, nothing like this. Mm. It was... Our only problems were through exhaustion and tiredness. Mm. And as for having come under attack from enemy aircraft, there's no question of people, you know, getting sick or something of that sort. Mm. It's entirely a modern invention.
Do you think anything might be done to remedy that, the effects of that modern invention? Is there any remedial...
Say it again?
Could there be any remedial measures against this modern invention?
About operational stress, you mean? Mm. Absolutely none. No. I mean, anyway, rather like President Clinton, you know. He doesn't have any operational stress because they're not involved in the war, really, these airplanes.
I think after Benghazi, he went back to Montgomery as one of his LOs, didn't he?
Yeah.
Mm. He mentioned Montgomery several times, and amongst other things, you mentioned his great concern for physical fitness.
Yes.
Do you think he was right to be concerned about the state of physical fitness in Eighth Army?
Well, he was a bit sceptical of the Desert Army. because, as he said, the men looked very fit and bronzed and all the rest of it, but none of them walked a mile since they came into the desert, because everyone was riding in vehicles. So they really weren't quite so fit as they looked. Mm-hmm. And I think this is quite true.
Mm-hmm. The other thing you mentioned is that there was... defeatism in Cairo at the time when he arrived.
Yeah.
What were the signs of that defeatism?
Well, we were at the end of the road. We'd never been driven so far back. we were only, the Alamein line was only 60 miles from Alexandria. And the nature of desert war up to that time was a war maneuver. And there was always somewhere else to go to if a withdrawal was necessary. In fact, withdrawal was part of their tactics, whether to lure the enemy on or for your own safety. And there was always another position. There were no further positions we could defend. And so we really had to stand at Alamein. But the powers that be at the time had decided that evacuation might be necessary, and GHQ was busily burning all their paper secret documents, and base depots had been moved up to Palestine and those parts. This had already happened. And so they were already preparing for the worst. And the most dramatic thing about Montgomery when he arrived and his initial speech to the officers of 8th Army within about 2 days of his arrival, and he said to them, there is too much defeatism, or worse that effect, and we will stand and fight here. If we can't stay here alive, we'll stay here dead. See, they thought this was quite a novel idea.
Another thing you mentioned about him is his great concern to have time to think.
Yeah.
Was that an unusual characteristic in a senior officer at the time?
Absolutely, but a very laudable one, because if he stayed at his main headquarters, he would have been subject to an absolute stream of visitors, and it would have been impossible to think clearly and fight the battle. And he found this in Normandy, actually, when his tech headquarters was very vulnerable to visitors. And we had Winston, then we had De Gaulle, and then we had all these people wanting to take up his time, because he should have been concentrating on the front. So it was a very wise move of his, and he kept himself, he rigorously controlled the number of visitors that came to see him, and he did have time to think, and he used to spend part of the day doing this. I mean, by that time he had a caravan, and he tried to divine what Rommel's next move would be, and he had a large photograph of Rommel in the caravan, which he used to gaze at, and he was very, very clear-minded. He probably woken up with a cup of tea at 6 o'clock in the morning, and he spent from 6 to 7 thinking about the day's events and receiving the initial reports. And by the time he got up, he was clear as to what he wanted to do.
So was it then that first hour in the morning after waking up with his cup of tea that where he did his important thinking, his most important thinking?
Yes, I mean, he was sitting up in bed, and he may have had an initial report come through about what had gone on the night before. He was actually thinking about his next move and what he planned to do that following day.
How would he spend the rest of the day after that first hour of thinking and receiving initial reports?
Well, the rest of the day was breakfast.
Would that be a working breakfast or a solitary breakfast?
Well, he had some of the officers around. I mean, the information which he was using to plan the following day was the information he'd received the night before.
So he'd slept on that.
Yeah.
So he'd received the information in the evening, he'd have his night's sleep,
yes,
wake up, sit in bed with his cup of tea and think it through.
And he'd had everything he wanted by the evening, because he'd had the normal reports coming through. Mm. He'd had conversations with various commanders on the not-very-efficient, difficult to speak on, clear, really.
Yes.
But he'd had the reports of his liaison officers about various sectors of the front and what was happening and what the commanders thought. So he slept, as you say, he slept on this information. Next morning, he had a moment of stillness and thought as to what his next moves were going to be. And then, after breakfast, he would then set out to visit one or other sector of the front, usually accompanied by both liaison officers, either driving him or following with a jeep. And then, from there on, we would be sent off to various sectors of the front to see other commanders and find out what's happening. And report to him 6 o'clock in the evening.
When you reported to him after such a visit, how would he conduct that debriefing? Would he expect you to make an initial report and then ask specific questions, or did he ask you questions?
No, we went into the caravan beforehand and marked up the mat with the latest battle situations, which he took off our map board, and which had been given to us by the commander who we'd been to see. So having done that, we would then go in at 6 o'clock, one after the other, and we would briefly explain what the changes were and what the situation we had seen was and what the divisional commander, whoever it was, had said. He'd ask a few questions, and then we go out.
How long would it normally take for him to actually debrief?
Quarter of an hour.
Quarter of an hour.
No more. 10 minutes.
Now, by joining this staff of his, you were really moving from an irregular form of warfare into assisting a man who believed in the large scale. Set piece form operation. How did you find that shift?
Well, it was very interesting to me because I hadn't experienced this before. And the orderly fighting of war was quite a novelty, as indeed it was to many of the soldiers who'd been out in the desert. And I was very impressed. You see, the artillery was used for the first time, as artillery should be used. I mean, in theory, there had been divisional artillery. It was never used as divisional artillery, but the artillery was used en masse and in particularly in the initial stages, in the form of creeping barrages, which was something entirely new to the desert veterans, because they'd been swanning about the desert.